Okay, so hello and welcome everyone to whoever's listening to this particular podcast. Today we have with us Divya Thakkar. He is a program manager and one of the founding members of Google Research in India. He is actively involved and leading strategic programs that connect academia and research at Google. Programs that focus on AI for social good initiatives and educational programs for schools in India, with a particular focus on building computer science foundations. And I also know Divya because he's from my same college. He was a senior to us and a spectacular person as managing activities. So Divya, thanks a lot for joining on this podcast and thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for doing all the work that you're doing to make research more accessible. That's an amazing initiative and I really appreciate the work that you're doing. And yes, it's always good to meet people from the same alma mater in research specifically. So yeah, especially good to be here.
Awesome. So in order for people to learn more about you, as in, I have been following a lot of your work, but in general, can you tell us a bit about your background prior to joining Google?
Yeah, for sure. So I did like a computer science undergrad. It was information and communication technology, but yeah, broadly, it was computer science, which is what I did in undergrad. And DICT is a very interesting space in that way, like our undergraduate institution, where you don't just learn the nuances of technology, but you also learn the implications of it, right? So there's a very active interest in humanities. And unfortunately, they called economics also humanities, which I'm sure not a lot of people would agree with, but we had these fantastic professors who would also teach us economics and the ways in which technology affects that for people. So we had like a fantastic professor, Alka Parikh, who's a PhD from Cornell, specializing in like agricultural economics, who I ended up working with quite a bit, both for my undergraduate summer internship as well as my thesis. So she was like a very key influence as well while I was in my undergraduate institution, because she kind of brought that lens of not just thinking about the technology, but also thinking about what it actively does. So we did a lot of field work with her. We did a lot of like visits as well to understand the impact of these kind of technologies on real world people. So that was like a big influence. And broadly, I think like the space in itself, the undergraduate institution, was a very fine place in the way that it was an active space where research was kind of encouraged. But for some reason, I never thought of research as a career path, to be honest. It seemed far off. I did not seem to be very well connected with all the research advances. And it's almost funny, right? Because 2013, 2014 was where a lot of these deep learning breakthroughs were happening. But still, the kind of information that we had, or even how to get into those spaces, was very limited. And I think it's very critical that initiatives like this help bridge those gaps. But broadly also, like undergraduate institutions provide those chances. So I never got excited about, like machine learning research in the same way at that point of time. So after that, like because I was interested in some form of economics and its impact on technology, I decided, okay, what are my options? And to be honest, like a master's in the US seemed very, very expensive, honestly, which I did not want to take on like a big student loan at that point of time. And I was like, okay, maybe the closest thing that comes to it is probably an MBA. So I went on to my MBA in IFT Delhi, which is the Indian Institute of Foreign Trade, with the hope that I'd do a lot more economics. And once I went to IFT, I guess like I got very interested, apart from economics, also in just like these marketing-like things, to be honest. And the perspective of marketing that I was seeing was more on the lines of understanding needs a lot. And that's kind of like a constant theme across undergrad and postgrad that I saw, was just this understanding, not just of how something happens in itself, but rather how it interacts with humans in like a meaningful way. And I remember like on the very first day when I was in this professor's class, Professor Rupal Walia, she was like fantastic. And she was our marketing professor. I was like completely interested in how she spoke about people and how that kind of like plays a role into, you know, how people use things, right? And I went up to her at the end of my first class and I'm like, ma'am, I love your class and I'd love to get a PhD at some point. So those were my first words to her when I met with her, because I was always interested in research, but I just did not understand the world of research, to be honest, in a very meaningful way. So I just went about the usual set of things. I went through like my postgrad, like I was studying the right courses, doing the right kind of like, you know, case studies and so on and so forth. But there was always something missing is what I felt. And I got a campus placement as well in like one of these consulting firms. And somewhere around that is when I realized, okay, I want to do something different. I don't want to do this. I mean, consultants do, of course, fantastic work, but I just realized I didn't want to do that. And at the same point of time, there's this particular position opening up in my now manager's team, who's always been my manager, by the way, Ashwini. And it was a contract position firstly, so it seemed very risky at that point of time, right? Nobody out of preschool takes a contract position. It's like almost like contract positions are not even well understood in India. And it was something to do with research and something to do with education is all I understood. And that just excited me so much. And like, okay, I want to be a part of that world, not this world. So at that point of time, I took a leap of faith. I'm like, okay, I'm going to take a risk. I'm too young to not take a risk. And eventually did, which of course was one of the best things I did in my life. And I started working at Google right out of grad school. I started out, of course, on a fixed term position, and of course later moved full time. And I've grown my career also at Google in the last almost 5 years. So it's been a very meaningful ride. I've always been with Google Research. I've always been, seeing the advances in science in the most profound way coming out of these particular laboratories. And I was very fortunate to be a founding member of the India Lab, which is one of the biggest labs that Google has, or potentially the biggest lab Google has in the Global South, which is very, very exciting. And I've gotten to work on very meaningful things, including like connecting dots between academia and Google Research, supporting the research ecosystem, doing more for the education stuff at K-12 to like modernize the CS education curriculum, and just work on like, you know, meaningful AI technologies for social good in a way that it addresses those equity gaps, right? Where people like you and I have access to all the progress in AI, but many people don't, right? So I think throughout the thread, I think the one thing that kind of like stands constant is just my interest in the intersection of technology and humans. And that's kind of like just kept me excited, and just my association or excitement by the research world and just being fascinated by what professors do. And I continue to be fascinated, and I just feel so privileged that in my current position, I get to work with some of the topmost academics in the world and try to like, you know, figure out like how we can work with them even more. So yeah, I think there's always been that fascination with research, and I'm just like a kid in a candy store who's always amazed and fascinated by all the amazing things that's happening around him. And that's why I also started pursuing research in HCI, thanks to a fantastic, fantastic mentor that I found here, who's Dr. Nitya Sambasivan. And it's just fascinating on what good mentorship does to you. So apart from all this interest, I think there's a lot of luck. I think that kind of like played into where I am today, and also a lot of good mentorship, both from my manager Ashwini Sharma, as well as, you know, people who supported me throughout and just taken chances on me even when they weren't really supposed to. I don't know what they saw. Maybe they were wrong, maybe they were right, but it kind of worked out okay.
Yeah, I really like, as in like the trajectory you have, like you have a strong base in technology, then you explode your interest in people. And this is something I always try to emphasize in a lot of other podcasts, I think with Dr. Tambe and Dr. Gupta, which also kind of now connect the dots, as in you have this interest of using technological advances at the forefront of how people use it and how people interact with it, which I think was also reflected in those podcast when they said like how AI for social good is really important for people to focus on, rather than just focusing on research and improving the metrics that might not reflect in the real world. And which I do find it very, very biased, as in most of the research, if you see, they don't take into factors as in humans interactions and how people will actually use these, but they are just improving one very small metric that has been constant for over the years. So I think it makes sense how you were selected for this particular position. It really fits into the equation what they wanted from a person with your background. But we'll talk more about the human interaction thing. But in order to learn more, like you, your role as at Google Research is as a program manager. So can you talk to us more about like what kind of programs are you managing or leading, and what do they look like? As in, what is the end goal, and what are your duties, ideal duties as a, like what is your workspace routine looking like as a program manager at Google?
Yeah, for sure. Before that, Jay, if you don't mind, I'll just quickly comment a bit on your comment, which I think is, of course, like super critical, right, in terms of knowing that we need more people to be excited by this space, right, and thinking about considerations of technology for humans. But at the same time, I do think that there's very deep value for both kind of work, and there's space for all kinds of research, yeah, right? So as long as I think people, yeah, are thinking responsibly about their research, and even in your research, right, if you're looking at medical imaging and you're thinking about how it affects the and a person who's going to be using it, who's going to be in a vulnerable state of like, you know, a particular health condition and so on and so forth. So I think it's important, and there's a lot of space for fundamental research as well. And that's what we do at our lab too. And we've been very fortunate, right? Again, I was talking about mentorship. I've gotten like tons of that from like Manish and Melinda as well, and they've supported me, yeah, the career, but we also work on fundamental research, and it's like very critical to do that and also make space for this. But just, yes, everything can coexist, right? It's not a zero sum game, especially research isn't. So
True, agree. Yes.
Yeah. So in terms of my day-to-day responsibilities, I think I joke around with people that I do meetings and I write emails and documents. I think that's all my job is. But of course, I kid. Like, I think there's the job is interesting in the way that my day-to-day work is mostly just trying to figure out a very healthy balance between programs that are already launched and are on, like, you know, the existing mode and making sure that they are running successfully. There's a part of programs that are about to launch and, you know, just preparing for those launches and making sure things land successfully and so on and so forth. And the third is kind of like looking ahead almost all the time, right? Like, what do we need next? Where is the world going? You know, and always just making space for that deep work to think through what researchers at our lab or broadly at Google would need and making sure that even before they need it, we try to think of solutions to those or think of programmatic approaches to do those, right? So programs could be on a wide variety of things, right? So for example, one of the programs that I'm really proud of that I worked with Ajay Milan, then Manish on was, and some of our colleagues at Google.org was, okay, there's this, you know, deep interest from NGOs who are struggling, you know, with certain set of problems where they've tried different approaches, but potentially AI could help in a meaningful way, right? Where there's some form of, for example, like in our case, some form of like allocation to be done, prediction to be done, or resource optimization to be done, right? Which are the kind of flavors of problems that people face in public health, especially in India, or NGOs face in India. And then there are academics who are like, you know, some of the topmost researchers who are very motivated to work on meaningful problems, but don't necessarily always have the avenues to work on those or the right partners to work on those. And then there's Google researchers who, of course, work on the research side, but also have the ability to, you know, productionize research or scale research on like Google scale and so on and so forth. So we decided to form this like, you know, tripartite programmatic framework, which was to bring the NGOs, academics, and Google researchers together in a meaningful way by providing them not just with, you know, financial support, which is of course a part of the program, but also making sure that they have the right kind of, you know, technical collaborations and frameworks to be able to working on these kind of problems, right? So the beauty of this kind of work is that it enables new projects that would not have existed otherwise. So it's not just about funding existing research, but thinking of ways to create new frameworks that would enable new collaborations that are also very, very impactful for the society, right? So that's like the kind of work that excites me. And I was so privileged and happy that I was a part of it from the day one. And I got to design this program and scale it up. So we designed this program in 2019 and eventually launched it in 2020 for 6 projects in India. Then we scaled it up to like 30 projects in 2021 to not just India, but the full of APAC and Sub-Saharan Africa. Where, you know, NGOs are from these two regions, but the academics are from all over the world. And now we are going to be further scaling this up to new regions, right? So that's the kind of work that a program manager does, actually thinking through the nuances of such program, designing these strategies firstly to understand what are the unique needs of the ecosystem, what are the unique needs of the researchers here, and making sure you tie it all together in a programmatic framework in a way that it can be reused further as well. So for example, we launched it in India for 6 and then we had to scale it up to 30. We were kind of like using those same programmatic principles that we had for the 6 and now we scale it up to new regions. We'll be using the same principles that we used for these 30, right? So it's a lot of that kind of juggling across strategy, execution, and working with researchers and communicating and managing a large number of stakeholders. And it could also go on side of the research side of things, right? So for example, if I'm working on a particular research project, there'd be a lot of, so this is like, you know, where I have to launch new projects. But if I'm working on an existing research project, there's a lot of nuances around kind of figuring out with your researchers, you know, what's the right sort of things that we should be working on. Okay, if our research team has, you know, like 5 researchers and we have this, you know, like 20 research agendas here, how do we like, you know, scope, rescope in a way that it kind of works for us? And we do the most meaningful things, which are best suited for our team to tackle on and so on. So there's a lot of like ongoing day-to-day conversations that you have with your researchers. And then of course, lots of planning and like, you know, lots of creation of artifacts, which helps bring together everyone on the same page, you know, be it like say program trackers, program chatters, like responsibility matrices and so on. So forth. So there's a large number of things that you do, but the day-to-day kind of shuffles between those 3 broad headers that I spoke about. And this one example, I hope gives an example of what really are the kind of programs that we do.
Yeah. So from what I gather, it's like, to be honest, it's a lot of things that you guys are thinking, as in like thinking a lot ahead, thinking a lot of at the moment, you're managing a lot of things, mapping from one place to another. But in terms of a concrete sense, are there any ways like for example, in software development, we have like software development cycles, right? You go through initiation phase, conceptualization, then also like prototyping, and I think scaling it to a lot of skills. So I'm curious, like, does program manager kind of duties, or in general any managerial duties, have these kind of development cycles? Can you walk us through the life cycle of a particular program that you first of all envision that, okay, this is something you want to introduce within your Google Decent umbrella, and what are the phases till you conclude that, hey, this thing is done and this will continue maybe for a long time because it's a good program. Can you walk us through that life cycle?
Yeah, for sure. So I can take an example and probably hopefully that will help it. So for example, one of the frameworks that we follow in the AI for Social Good group is the Data to Deployment framework, which a bunch of researchers have created. It essentially captures all the nuances of working through all the way from the data collection stage, which is so critical in like this AI for Social Good context, right? So there's subparts to each of these stages that we have. There's a piece around prototyping that we have, just like you spoke about prototyping. We'll have, you know, doing some kind of like statistical analysis to kind of form our hypothesis. We'll move, once we have formed that, once we have, you know, worked through that data phase all the way into the statistics phase of that data, then we'll move towards like the modeling and the algorithmic side of things. Then we'll kind of go into the productionizing side of things to make sure that this research can actually work in the real world. Of course, there's, you know, big component of like testing and evaluation going on in between, including things like, you know, fairness indicators and so on and so forth. And then it kind of goes into the deployment phase, right? Where the deployment is not just about the algorithmic aspects, but a lot of how it fits into existing systems of this particular organization and how it will smoothly work into the workflow of what the particular NGO is doing and so on and so forth. So broadly, that framework varies, I guess, from different teams to different teams, especially based on what kind of work that they're doing or what domain they're in. But I think a lot of it is dependent on the kind of technologies. For example, if you're working on language models, a large part of that time would also be spent on the data side, right? Because you're gathering the right set of data sets, and there's a large amount of work that you're doing to make sure that you're working with the right set of like community partners or agencies or, you know, users themselves directly to kind of gather this data. You're forming the right protocols to get their consent, making sure it's informed consent, and so on and so forth. But broadly, this is the framework that we follow for the AI for Social Good group, and different teams kind of follow different frameworks. But I guess it's similar in that way that you're trying to go all the way from data to make sure you form the hypothesis, to make sure that you can model based on that hypothesis, you do the right kind of like evaluation, observe those metrics, and go into like production. Or, and that production could be anything, right? That production could also be a paper, because you're just writing up those results for a paper. Or the production could be, if you want to say, launch that particular model into a Google product, which then follows like a different cycle. So it varies a bit, but that production term can be loosely interpreted into different kind of cycles.
Interesting. And I think you also did mention, as in you are also trying your hands on with the research aspect, as in you are just not involving yourself into the program managing aspect, but you're also trying to explore your interest into research, like maybe slightly on the area of how computer science researchers operate. So can you talk more about that? Like, as in something, are you doing that out of your interest, or is it something you people should learn as a part of being a program manager, like trying to do what the program's actually trying to do, like trying your hands on with research? Is it something you are exploring on your own? And if so, how are you liking it, and versus how are you learning that? Are you learning from online, or what mediums are you using to learn those things? Kids?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Jay. I think honestly, you could do like, you know, the program manager work in isolation, but if you have to be a good program manager, if you do it in isolation, you won't be a very good one, in my honest opinion. It's a very personal mm-hmm. one. And the reason I say that is because, if, for example, if someone is working on multi-agent systems, which we do, for example, right? And if you're not able to understand what the modeling techniques are, or if you don't are not able to interpret the results that are coming out of it, it's okay if you don't get the nitty-gritties of, you know, the theorems that are being proven and so on and so forth. But if you don't understand at a broad level of what's going on in the research, I don't think you're able to take decisions on what you should be working on, right? And you're not able to have those meaningful conversations with your researchers on prioritization and launches and so on and so forth, right? It's always going to be a bit high-level, hand-wavy kind of a thing. So for that, I think it's very critical to immerse yourself into the area that you're working in. And to be honest, I don't know, it's not very difficult to immerse yourself once you kind of like build a framework for learning new things, and people have different frameworks for learning new things. And for me, it's like, you know, just broadly being able to relate it back to things that I've already learned. And that's what I do to kind of like go through these new techniques that I come across, and especially when you work in like, you know, research lab where people are doing like, you know, the coolest things in science, it's important that you have frameworks that help you understand the thing in a succinct way and in a meaningful way where you're not getting lost in too much detail, right? Which is very critical. Like I can't be reading, you know, hundreds and hundreds of computational game theory papers. If that's not my area of expertise, it won't lead me to like a farther off place. But if I'm able to understand key results that are coming out of these papers and think through, okay, here are the latest deployments, advances in this particular space, and maybe we could try out something like that. It just puts me in a much more interesting programmatic decision-making process. With regards to my own research, I think a lot of it is driven by just problems that I'm seeing arise from the context that we work on, right? So I think the best part about working in a research lab is there's ever an abundance of research problems that you are encountering, because there's just, you know, very interesting things happening anywhere and everywhere you look. And it's almost impossible to not get inspired by the science happening around you, right? So for example, the recent paper that I've done with my co-authors at Georgia Tech, IIT Madras, and Google, it kind of examines this particular problem in data valuation, which is inspired by a lot of the work that we've seen in the AI for social good space, right? On how data changes hands and how kind of like valuation is a critical aspect of that data, but it gets frequently lost and so on and so forth, right? In terms of how you can go about learning it, I think especially for research side of things, I think it's very important to be a part of some form of reading group. And that reading group can be either with the same kind of people that you are with, for example, with program managers. But I think it's more valuable to be in reading groups with researchers themselves and ask those stupid questions, because the best thing about the research world is that people are very kind mostly most instances, and they're like happy and very passionate to talk about their work, and they're happy to address even like, you know, stupid questions like people like me would have. So it's very easy to ask them to contextualize this. And one thing I've found is that researchers are also really appreciate the unique perspective that you bring in, right? So for example, whenever I've asked questions around fairness or responsibility or interpretability, inspired by the things that I see on the ground and how that relates to their modeling decisions, it frequently inspires modeling decisions themselves, right? Because there's this very real world thing that the researcher might have missed, and now they know that there's this particular intuition that they could follow, which they've been inspired by you. So I've had like very meaningful research discussions with people in the room to make sure that there's some kind of value that I'm adding to those discussions. And yeah, it's mostly a process of just stumbling across different papers, just trying to learn what's happening and creating a framework that kind of like works for you on what information you need to distill from these papers, and then seeing how it kind of applies to your work. But I really think it's difficult to be a very good program manager without knowing the domain that you work on, because you'll just be like still high level and you won't be able to make those deep contributions that, you know, you can if you explore your full potential, in my honest opinion.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. And maybe like adding to one of the comments, that being part of the research is something I have also seen having a great value. For example, the projects that I'm working on involves a lot of medical experts, and they don't necessarily need to jump into the ideas of how to use AI models or deep learning models, but they definitely try and show their interest. And one of the few things that actually the beautiful things I would say that has we have benefited is actually one of the few projects that we are working on, it has a very, very small data set. So we have to be really careful of using AI models, and we were almost at a deadlock. So we weren't finding anything interesting. We were sure the data was good, but it was just in small amounts. And just because few people who were from medical background, they had no idea how actually neural networks work, they tried to ask a lot of questions like, hey, why are you doing this? Why are you using these metrics? Why are you training this model in a particular sense? And at one point, she pointed out in one of the meetings that we should not be doing this because this does not align with the medical idea of how patients are treated. And that actually, like, we are now coming to a publication which actually now makes sense, that how we as computer science normally, because we have tons and millions of images, right? So we have structured our experiments in such a sense, but that does not have to be the gold standard of how you train models, interpret models and results. So I like the idea of how, like, for example, you are managing a particular program and you have a long vision. And hence, if you have some hands-on on at least interpreting why a particular model is trained or why the data set is being treated in certain sense, then you might have a different perspective to offer to the engineers or the researchers who are working on it. So I love that idea in general. So yeah, definitely.
And domain expertise, as you're saying, right, like just inspires real problems also for computer scientists to kind of like think about, right? So I think like domain expertise outside of computer science for computer scientists to think about is really critical. And that's something that we aim to do in our work as well, right? Because that kind of like grounds you in the realities of what the failure modalities of your models or your technologies are going to be in the real world. And that's just so critical. And I've met many people, including many people say this, but like Milind and Manish more profoundly have said this many times, like sparsity, either in data or in compute, is not a limitation. It's a challenge for computer scientists to figure out like new techniques that work in that kind of like sparsity, right? So treating sparsity as either data sparsity or anything else in like as a limitation to, you know, not do computation in like meaningful ways is, or just say that we're going to use this, you know, like very computationally expensive technique like neural networks is, it's not in the best interest of like that domain, right? Because they don't have that kind of same data resources that others might. So yeah, it's like an interesting problem faced to computer scientists when they encounter sparsity and domain expertise, because it like grounds them in the realities of where the technologies might fail. So yeah, completely agree with you. And yeah, very interesting to hear about your work in medical too.
Yeah. And coming to a question that I would like to specifically ask from a very technical, boring engineering perspective, and which is something I find it interesting and I've always struggled to understand, is you mentioned a lot of strategic thinking that goes into the program managing aspect, but it involves a lot of looking ahead, as in understanding what are the future demands or whatever the, like mapping a multiple amount of metrics, as in the organization's metrics versus what problem needs to be solved. But I'm curious, how do you learn those skills? As in like we as like, if you're going through a completely pure engineering background, those skills are not really taught to you as a student, unless you have some kind of industry experience. So I'm curious that in your experience, you have a lot of industry experience even before joining Google. And also you are a management student. So you might have a certain along those lines of insights too. So I'm curious, how does one build these kind of skills in order to pitch it to someone that, hey, I actually have these kind of strategic thinking mindset, and hence I could be a good fit for a managerial job. So I'm curious to learn more.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Let me think about it in a way that it makes sense and is of coherence.
I understand, yeah, it's a very subjective. Yeah, it's a very subjective definition. I think there's not a very technical answer, I think, but I won't interrupt. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll take a stab and tell me if it doesn't make sense. So I guess the thing that matters for these kind of like program management, product management like jobs, of course, there are like, you know, these online courses available. So I won't talk about that. I'm just going to talk about what you can do individually apart from taking these courses, is to kind of like find space for taking on work that involves some form of like, you know, strategic thinking, which all of work kind of like involves, right? Be it your class projects, think through some kind of ways in which you're going to be planning that project or program, right? In a meaningful way, be it a research project or be it a product or software engineering oriented project. And think through ways in which you are able to think about, okay, here is what are the risks of taking this approach, right? And it could be risks of taking one model choice over the other, one architecture over the other. It could be thinking through the data strategy in a bit more detail and thinking through, okay, here are the failure modalities, here are the kind of like fairness indicators that we won't meet if we take this approach, and so on and so forth, right? So wherever you see yourself taking these kind of decisions in any particular research project, including your class projects, and I'd say especially your class projects, because you're working in groups of like, you know, 4 to 5, and you're like, you know, in a larger group where a lot of organization needs to be done, right, to make sure that people stay focused, everybody knows what information they need to make sure that they are successful in their own thing, and that individual kind of contributions leads to a larger thing, which is a successful project, class project in this example, right? So I'd say that find opportunities to do that kind of work in your class projects, in your case studies that you might do if you're a management student, and just figure out some kind of love for frameworks. And have those frameworks and plans not to like execute them, but just to have a definition to what you're doing, right? So it's not important that you stick to the every word of that framework or that plan, but just have a plan to make sure that things can happen in a certain rhythm and a certain way. And it's, of course, okay to evolve over the course. And there are like many people, including myself, who learn particular frameworks and try to apply them in different contexts. So for example, I love like one of these go-to-market strategy frameworks that I learned all the way back in my B school, and I try to apply it to very different contexts, even if that was meant for like a completely different setting in which I learned it, right? So I guess like one, find opportunities to do this kind of work in like strategy planning, execution like work, and just, you know, bringing out people together in like a cohesive way, communicate often, manage different people in like a meaningful way in all opportunities that you get. And do try to think of frameworks and stick to a framework that you like. By stick to it, I mean, of course, evolve it in ways that it works for you, but like kind of figure out like some kind of frameworks that help guide your thinking in an interesting way, even if it's not sharpened to it right now, right? So the thing is that not everybody's kind of like, you know, naturally born into it or anything, right? It's just a bunch of frameworks that you learn over the course of your career. And when I joined Google Program Management, I did not know anything about program management. I joined right out of grad school, so I had no industrial experience apart from an internship that I did at eBay, which was in a completely different area, even if it was in a tech world, right? So just find opportunities to do this kind of work. And I hope kind of the rest will fall into place once you start developing this frame of mind towards doing it. The artifacts piece of it, right, in terms of like what you need to create as a program manager, will come as a byproduct of this thinking rather than you creating those artifacts to meet this thinking, right? So yeah, that's my broad answer to it. I don't know if it's too helpful, but I hope it at least gives some ways to think about these kind of problems.
Yeah, no, I really like the analogy as in when you refer to as in class projects, like focusing on class projects in a different sense, which is something very strikingly interesting to me. Is it in very pure engineering projects, we normally focus on maybe like the current step or maybe like the next two steps that we are trying to work on or at least solve. But I think in these kind of scenarios for strategic thinking, you have to think about the step one to step n, where n is the like the end goal that you want to reach. And I think having a bird's view on all those steps is something I think is the differentiating factor between being a software engineer versus program manager. I think not a lot of projects are designed for us to think like that, but it's very interesting and I think very useful that people should be focusing on. So yeah, I think if I understand this correctly, that should be a key thing people should learn in order to build a profile for these kind of jobs.
Yeah, and to be honest, Jay, like I've seen many very successful leaders do this naturally, like engineering and research leaders who do this kind of thinking naturally, right? And they don't necessarily need a program manager. So end of the day, I recognize and I realize, and I always say this, that, you know, program managers, at least I'm in service of the research team and the research ecosystem, right? So making sure that those teams are successful, because end of the day, they're doing the science, they're doing the engineering, and you're there to like kind of enable their work rather than do their work. So in some way, you can kind of like develop these. So even if it's not ingrained into any project that you do, it still kind of is a part of it. And the project can just be more successful or quicker or, you know, more efficient or just more robust or whatever it is, whatever metric you're measuring against. If you have this kind of like program management framework to it, I mean, end of the day, projects can still happen without program management. I recognize that, right? It's just that it could happen in a different way or in like a slightly more efficient or robust way if you kind of follow these principles. And I don't think it's just necessary for people to do this because they want to get into program management. They can just do this even as like being engineers and researchers themselves, because it would just enable their work in like very meaningful directions and grow them into more strategic leadership like positions as well, right? Because end of the day, if you are like, you know, an L3 SWE at Google, who's going to grow, you will grow into like management positions, right? So if you want to grow, you would need to develop some kind of like, you know, strategic foresight or some kind of like way in which you plan things and bring out things together, especially as you start managing teams. And this is not true just for Google, but all tech companies, I'd say.
Yeah, and even I'd like to extend, not even just tech companies, like in a very loosely sense, even for academia, like I'm involved with my professor, and something I learned that I didn't learn as a graduate student, but now as a PhD student, I'm trying to learn is like, I thought like research was all about publishing papers and like improving the metrics, but actually that there is a much more stronger backbone to it, as in the grants that they are trying to work on, as in like each particular grant has multiple key points, and that is something they have written. Maybe like, for example, the grant I'm working on was written in 2017 or something, which they already laid out the points, as in this is what we want to do, this would be the end deliverables and something. And once we publish one paper, my professor says, okay, read these particular grant points, and now we should be focusing on the next. And I was like, oh, this thing is actually planned by my professor. This is not something just happening in a very discovery mode and aha moment of Aristotle. It's not something that just magically happens. So I think this is something very interesting, but I think, like you said, you naturally grow into it. So I think professors who have worked on these professors or any senior person, I would say, as a researcher who has worked on these kind of projects for a long time, they actually know how these life cycles inherently look like. So I think a lot of people grow into these kind of roles, and versus few people have a love for this. So I think, yeah, it's a multi-entry approach. I think a lot of people can grow into it, and versus people can go out of interest. But I'm curious, one thing you did mention is you did not have directly, or like in terms of statistically speaking, on your resume program management experience before you joined Google. So I'm curious, and a lot of people listening to this podcast might be curious, like, what was your process like, and how did you prepare for the Google interview versus how was the interview like, and what were the expectations that you can maybe reflect back on, saying that, hey, actually I answered this, but they were looking for something else, or maybe they were actually looking for something. So can you talk about the whole interview process in much more student-friendly sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something that I've been working on, as you might know, to just kind of like, you know, democratize access to these roles in tech beyond software engineering, right? So I'm just working on this interview series too, about where I'm talking about these specific goals. So you can check that out too. I guess like there are different kind of roles, different kind of like interview types that you get as a program manager, right? So one is just problem solving, or what I call case-based situations, where you're given hypotheticals which are not related to your domain and you're still addressing those. So over there, what they're trying to look for is your ability to think through very, very complex factors or varying complex factors in a short amount of time in a completely new context that you've not seen before, right? So this is not like your traditional testing your program management skills, but it's just testing your problem solving skills. So that's critical to pretty much like all interviews that I've seen across, like, you know, these big tech companies or even probably in tech companies, right? So problem solving is absolutely critical. And my advice over there is, again, like I talk about frameworks a bit, but think of like, you know, mental models or frameworks that would help you think through those complex factors in a short amount of time. So that's like one type of interview that you'll get, I think, when you apply for program manager jobs, which I got to. The second type of interview that you'll get is actually, you know, core program management skills interview. So it's known by different names in different companies. Facebook calls it Program Sense, Google calls it like role-related program management interview, Amazon calls it program management interview, and so on and so forth. So over there, they're just testing, you know, your core program management skills, strategy and planning, how you execute, what parts of execution you look at, how you enable execution for others, and so on and so forth, right? So that's like your core program management interview that you need to prepare for with, again, just, you know, knowing about this program manager job and like thinking through those factors in that particular point of time with what you're given. Now, there are two kinds of questions, again, to this interview type. One is like hypothetical, where they're giving you a new situation. For example, if you have three stakeholder groups who have different priorities, and, you know, you're working on a program which can take care of only one, how would you go about selecting which one to prioritize, for example, right? The other is past experiences based. So can you tell me about a program that did not go well in the past? And what would you do differently if you had to approach it all over again, that kind of thing, right? So those are past experiences based. Of course, people who have not worked on program management would potentially think of giving answers about, again, you know, say class projects, or thinking through situations which are kind of like loosely related to this kind of work. But if it's not, it's completely okay to say that you've not had these experiences, right? The third kind is kind of like role-related interview again, which is like specific to the area that you're applying for. Say it's in education, or it's in like working with a specific kind of like communities, and so on and so forth, right? A particular kind of domain. So it would be like a domain knowledge interview of sorts. The last one is kind of just testing how you work with different people in like a meaningful way, making sure that, you know, you're someone who can work with different set of stakeholders, you can communicate well, and those kind of things. So I think those are the four broad categories of interview types you can expect as a program manager. And that's exactly what I had to when I interviewed with Google. And for people who don't have that background, I guess it depends, right? So if you're applying for junior level positions, they understand that you would not have the same kind of background. And for example, I know that Google, Facebook, Amazon, all of these have like, you know, program management internships as well, which is like a good way to get into this kind of position and develop those kind of skills. You can also apply. I think it's just such an interesting time to apply into academic labs, do this kind of like work as well, or centers, right? That there are these amazing centers that are coming up in academia where they need like this kind of help. So you could certainly reach out to professors or center heads if they need such kind of expertise. And lastly, startups, right? Startups are so many number, both in India and the US and all over the world right now. So working with them to make sure that you are able to convince them of the value that you can add as a program manager would be, of course, very, very important too. And yeah, broadly for preparation for these kind of interviews, I think number one thing is to be structured, communicate well, make sure that you're taking into account different factors, because as we've spoken about, looking ahead is a critical part of it. So you don't want to, and I think I'm just like a broken record about this, but risk mitigation strategy is very important, because you're very, very responsible for thinking through what the various risks towards a particular program or a research project could be. And you're responsible for thinking about it. So you better like think about it in advance, even in the interview itself. So yeah, those are some of the things that could be potentially helpful for interviews.
I see. And curiously asking, like, as in, would you recommend any resources for people to prepare? I know that is not a very structured, this is not a, like, it derives from a lot of the experience and your insights that you have gathered over the years. But I'm curious, like, are there any resources that you would recommend people for in order to prepare for these kind of interviews that you have come across to be good enough?
I don't know if any come to mind directly, because I haven't prepared for interviews myself in a while.
Yeah.
I could like maybe share a few over email and you could put them in the description. But I think there's plenty of YouTube videos which help with this, plenty of blogs, a lot of these websites, like, you know, which I'm not endorsing either in my personal or professional capacity, but, you know, places like Glassdoor, Blind, all of them have like, you know, past interview questions as well for these kind of roles. So maybe those are like helpful resources as well to know the flavor of questions and how people have answered those. And yeah, I guess I could think of more, but yeah, broadly, I think it depends on the domain that you're applying to. And if you have the fundamentals of problem solving and, you know, the program management skills in place, you could prepare for the domain accordingly after. But I'll try to think of more resources as well, and I'll try to share those with you over email.
Yeah. That's fine. That's fine. And one other question is, as in, I do understand the very surface level difference between the roles of a product manager, program manager versus a technical manager, as in product manager would be focusing more on the product's lifecycle versus program we already talked about, and technical manager would be focused on a feature that is particularly rolling out from that particular op. But is there any more insights to these differences that people should know while they're applying? Because I think if people are into if they want to transition to roles into managerial, how do they select their preferences, as in, do they want to be a technical manager versus product or versus a program manager? Are there any non-subtle differences that you might have insights on?
So the most covert difference, I guess, between a product manager and program manager in a research lab would be this. A program manager would exist even before the research, and this is specifically true for research labs, is that program managers would be involved before the research has even, like, you know, productionized, right? So before even you have the results to make sure that the research is successful and now it can go into the real world, program managers are there before that too. But product managers have this very, very unique ability to think through, okay, now that we have this particular, you know, advance in, say, language models, they would have the knack to like work with a lot of stakeholders in product teams to make sure that this research can now be scaled up to many, many more people, right? And that's what product managers at Google Research do, where they scale up these fundamental science advances into ways that they are meaningfully helpful to people across Google products, right? So that's the most subtle difference. Program managers are there even before the research is productionized, and product managers are typically around when the research is about to be productionized or is about to see the light of the real world. It's not to say program managers aren't involved after that. They are. They see through like the entire charter of the program, but that's specifically true for research labs. For product teams, I'd say that product managers are, again, like super critical to everything that they do, because product teams actively work on productionization, right? So a lot of the scoping is like done jointly between, say, product managers and program managers, where program managers are probably owning the launch a lot more, while the product manager would own a lot more of the scoping and the customer facing needs, right, to make sure that the product is actually, or whatever feature or entire product that you're working on, is accessible and making sure that it can see the light of the day and it's helpful for customers. So there are very subtle differences, I guess, in the product world. But in research world, I think they're a bit more kind of like obvious, I'd say. And there's like some very, very fantastic product managers that I've met. So for example, one person I'd recommend the viewers to check out is Tulsi Doshi, who's just done, you know, fantastic work as a product manager. And she's heading the entire responsible AI charter, I believe, for Google Research, or probably for all of Google right now. And she just does fantastic work. So both product managers and program managers can do like, you know, very, very interesting work. And at the same time, I know of this one fantastic program manager who's doing fantastic work in accessibility, Eve Anderson, who's heading up like Google Research's accessibility efforts. And she's managing research teams, UX teams, HCI teams, as well as, you know, program managers herself. So there's like just some fantastic people who are doing like both of these things. And I think a lot of the scope that you work on is also fluid in terms of like opportunities that are available around you and the opportunities that you find. I think the EM role, or the research manager, or the tech manager role, is kind of like the more obvious one in the way that you grow into that as a technical person, right? So if you, say, for example, join a research lab, you would grow into that and you would start managing researchers at some point as you grow into your career. But at the end of the day, you are managing that research charter and researchers are reporting to you and you are responsible for the, of, you know, how things will happen essentially, right? Because you have that expertise which nobody else does. And similarly for EMs, which is engineering managers, they're similar, where they have a large number of engineers reporting into them and they're figuring out like the architecture of, you know, what would happen for this particular product or project.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. And like, again, I might be picking on this particular topic too more than I need to, but as if, like, in order to build these strategic skills, would you try, like, if you were to look back, would you tie this to any kind of particular experiences that you think that really made you good at whatever you were doing as a program manager now? As in, like, would it be something, let's say, your course curriculum at IIFT? Or maybe even I at least know, like, you doing a lot of organization skills at DICT, and versus any other skills that do you think that played an important role for you to build these kind of knack for problems, as in thinking strategically versus what an engineer thinks, like much more on a very smaller basis of problem solving. So would you tie, if you were to look back, would you tie these experiences to a particular instance that made you really good at program manager?
Yeah, firstly, I disagree that engineers work on small things. I think they work on like very, very big things, and they work on like generally very, very ambitious problems. But I know what you mean in principle, but I'd just say that they do work on like these kind
one at a time. I think, yeah, I think like whenever, like in a broader sense, I think engineers are like working on smaller problem, smaller as in like they try to chunk those problems into various small parts and work one by one on them. But I think versus program manager has a very bird's view angle on all of these things. So it's no way trying to undermine the efforts of engineer, but it's just the way how they look at these problems. So yeah
absolutely. I know that wasn't your intent, but I'm just saying that like everyone does cool work. It's just a matter of what kind of cool work that you'd like to do. Agreed. Right, end of the day. I guess in terms of what helped me develop this, I think like one thing is just being on top of things, or just being a bit more organized about how you plan things is helpful as a skill, which I think kind of like came in handy when I did this kind of work, right? So just being a bit more proactive in terms of knowing when things are chaotic and putting in some kind of like structure to it, right? So of course you think of like a lot of like strategy courses and so on and so forth, but end of the day, it's about like putting structure onto like ambiguous situations, right? Which is very critical to what both a product manager and program manager do. So yeah, that's like one skill I think that came in handy that I'd learned from kind of like my earlier days. The second thing that came in handy was just, you know, being able to work through some kind of like, you know, models, be it like economic ones or financial ones or whatever, to think about different situations that help you think about risk, right? Which I think doesn't translate like one-to-one onto what a program manager does, but it's still like helpful to think through various factors that you learn in your coursework, and just being able to be trained in that way to think, okay, no, here are the fault lines or fault points for whatever you do, which I think is super, super important. Communication is, I think, as I keep saying, it's like very, very critical, and that flows across everything that you do, right? And that's something that you learn in pretty much all courses at B school or even undergrad for that matter. Yeah, and I think broadly just that computer science framework of thinking, right, which my entire degree was about, taking a problem one at a time, breaking it down into like, you know, smaller digestible problems and then tackling it is still very, very true for what any job does, including program manager, and just like, you know, working through it in smaller chunks, which don't overwhelm you, don't overwhelm people around you, and, you know, working on them in like a meaningful way. So yeah, I think that skill is always, always handy, I'd say. And yeah, all the foundations of learning computer science through undergrad were of course helpful, because I'm able to context switch well enough across, you know, like different research domains, being able to learn the right amount of information. Of course, I could do so much better, but it still helps provide like a baseline for learning these different things a bit faster, which I think is very, very helpful. I'd say yeah, that technical background does help to be successful, but I've seen so many program managers at Google, at Facebook, at Apple, and so on and so forth, don't come from technical backgrounds. By technical, I mean like computer science backgrounds. They could come from different engineering disciplines. So yeah, don't mark my words as a way to think that it just needs to be, you know, computer science undergrads and like people with management who get into program manager roles. People can grow into it eventually, but yeah, that needs to be that like quest or zeal to learn about that domain a bit more. And I think that's, in my honest opinion, it's inevitable that you learn the domain, because otherwise it doesn't help to be effective and like make meaningful contributions on any particular program.
Yeah. Because I was coming to that question very next one, as in like transitioning for tech people into these kind of managerial roles. But I think we already briefly talked and touched this particular topic earlier also. Like, you need to at least spend some amount of time with that particular product or whatever you're working on in order to build that bird's view angle in general. Like, you need to think through. So I think it takes some amount of experience or at least some amount of time before you graduate towards that particular role. So that makes sense. And I think
20% of projects are just working on the same project that you already are, even in academic settings, right? And I've seen some PhD students to be like, and professors are, I think naturally just they're like good program. Most professors, I think, are good program managers, because inherently they do a lot of this stakeholder management, right? Where they're working with like funding agencies and industry people and their collaborators and so on and so forth. So I think in some way everyone does it. It's just like kind of being a bit more intentional about it if you are like trying to transition into a career, but just realize where you're doing it already. And PhD students are like program managing all the time too. They're some of the busiest people that you'd ever see, right? Because they're just working like crazy hours and like, you know, getting through so many deadlines. And I've seen some PhD students to be so organized where they're writing like, you know, 4 papers at a time. And, you know, there's like different trackers for each of their collaborators, and they're like on top of everything, right? And that's like a good program management aspect. They're making 4 concurrent projects successful at the same time and with limited bandwidth from their side. So yeah, I think that happens any which ways, but if you're in the industry, you could look at taking up, you know, like 20% projects, or just taking up like a side project for your team or for a concurrent sister team or something like that, and try to like, you know, get your hands dirty just like by working on some of these things. And gradually, if you want to work through it, there's, you know, ways, hopefully within your company, but even if they're not, you can try to use that 20% experience as a leverage or a way to, you know, ask for a similar position in like a company which is working in a similar domain or something, because those skills are kind of intertransferable. And I've seen a lot of like program managers come from, for example, in my own team, like we have a program manager who's like, you know, a PhD in computer science, who's now heading up a particular part of our region for the work that we do. Similarly, another program manager, again, PhD in psychology, who's like, you know, very good at what they do and so on and so forth. So people can come from very different backgrounds again for this kind of work. It's just about that intentionality of what you're doing and putting like a word to it in some way.
Yeah, that makes sense. And like before we tune out, I just have one last question, and I think you also mentioned is about the organizational skills. As in, I always like to learn more about this, because in terms of organizing things, the all the things that I've learned how to organize these projects have been through my past internships, and where the people I'm working with are like managers, product managers, something. So I'm curious, do you have like, I assume you have a lot of things at one time going on. So do you have any insights on how to be better organized, as in like how you were before you joined as a program manager, being a student, messy, handling multiple things, not delivering maybe half of the things that you have on your plate, versus now delivering things in a much more consistent and robust fashion. Do you have any insights that people can take, like as in how to be better organized in general for anything, whatever they're doing? It doesn't have to be a program manager or a computer science student, but in general, any insights on being better organized?
Yeah, I think the best person that I've seen to answer this is probably Professor Devi Parikh, who has this like, you know, fantastic blog on calendar, not to-do list. So people should check that out if they already haven't.
Yeah.
But I'm not able to actually follow Professor Devi's system, to be honest. So like the system that works for me will be very different from the one that works for you. So I can tell you briefly on the system that works for me. So I get a lot of email. I get a lot of meeting requests and I'm managing multiple stakeholders. And when I'm in meetings, always there's an action item which comes upon me, right? So I have like this very simple formula. If it's not on my to-do list, it doesn't happen. So what I've done is that I have a Google spreadsheet where I've created, I show it to you actually and just present my screen. But it's essentially like I can read out the headers. There's a column for action items. There's a column for link, which is to lengthy documents. When it was assigned, when it's due, what's the priority for it? And that priority I've defined myself between, say, P0 to P4. What's the status of it? And how many days are left? And then there's this simple filter for this week. It's like that raw. And I have to enter yes or no to it. And if it's yes, the filter like keeps it on my system and organizes it by the priority and like when it's due and whether it's this week. And the to-do list essentially keeps growing and I just keep marking things as done. And as soon as I mark it, of course, it goes off, right? So that's my personal system of organizing my things. And it's very clear in terms of what I need to do because I don't want it to be in that way where I have a meeting from 4 to 4:30 and then I have like, you know, a gap between 4:30 and 5 and then my next meeting begins. So in that half an hour, it's very easy to get like, you know, overwhelmed by, oh, what do I do? Maybe I should just answer a few emails. Maybe I'll take a quick break. And then there's like no time left, right? So essentially it's, oh, by the way, I forgot to mention, I add a bracketed way in which I mention how much time each thing will take. So if I know I can just sift through like, you know, 2 15-minute tasks, I'll do that instead of just wasting away my time, for example, right? So that could be one way that works for me. And essentially everything on my email is very, very filtered. I get like only quality email because I've put in like a ton of filters on it, again, through like a system and everything that's labeled according to a way. And a lot of people have said this, I don't fully practice it, but I try to, which is like open each email only once. So I just open my email, either it goes to something from it comes to my action item list or my to-do list, or I just like, you know, archive it. So nothing stays, everything gets archived eventually, but I try to like reply to it saying, okay, I'm gonna get to this in a certain time frame and so on and so forth. And all of this is kind of like organized across having my own set of priorities for the week across different projects, right? So even if something is critical for this particular project, there might be a thing which is, you know, equally critical on another project. And so how do you evaluate between those two, right? So there are these more qualitative factors that I take into mind when I'm starting my week, where I know that I'm working on certain things. And at one particular point of time, this particular research project that I'm working on, I know needs my more time and attention. So I'll try to like prioritize that P0 over another P0 and so on and so forth. So of course, like some of it can be more, you know, quantitative through like a to-do list, but you'll always have to make those decisions in terms of what works best for you, what's critical for you in that moment. And yeah, I've tried to make sure that I don't go to meetings where I'm not absolutely needed, but it's always difficult to do that because at the same time you're making sure that someone else doesn't have to go to it so that you are able to represent what's happening and, you know, not like waste another researcher's time and so on and so forth. So it's difficult, but at the same time it's helpful for me to go in and, you know, show up and have that stakeholder relationship managed and so on and so forth. So it's not a bulletproof system, but it's one that's worked for me, I think, at least since the last 2 years. So this particular sheet has been, and I've tried very different methods. So I have this like particular diary where I try to maintain this cross off to-do list to get that satisfaction. But I just realized it did not scale because if I missed a to-do from this year, this week, transferring it over was like a big mess. So I just shifted to like the system. And by the way, I have the same system for my personal site. So I have a professional to-do list here. And on my personal tab, I'll have another one for my personal stuff. And it could be as simple as like, you know, call Jai or call Nana or whatever, right? So even those things get there. And it's just making sure that I don't get like overwhelmed on a Saturday thinking, okay, what do I do now? It includes things like meet this friend, because I forget that I have to, you know, call so many friends. So I just like try to keep it organized even in those ways. So it's just like little things to make sure I don't have to remember a ton of things. And my last productivity hack is, I think, like taking a lot of notes. So I'm just generally always taking notes in all meetings. It's mostly because I think like I focus much better if I'm taking notes. And secondly, because I forget things, so I have to like note down what actually was said, right? So I would remember potentially what I said, but I won't remember what the other person said. So I take like a lot of notes, and I've gotten fairly okay at like taking parallel notes while being in meetings, so which is like helpful for me. And I think people should just generally get good at taking notes, no matter what organizational ladder you are in, program manager, research scientist, whatever. You just need to take notes. I think it's just helpful to be organized, I guess, too. So yeah, those are some of the tricks.
Yeah, no, the thing I love most about is like I agree to most of the things that you just said, and like it mirrors a lot of things in my way. But the only difference is, I guess, you do end up doing your to-dos versus I don't end up doing my to-dos. But like it's a very similar thing. Like I started off using in a very similar sheet sense or Google Doc sense, where I would just mark my to-dos. I figured out I'm not able to complete my to-dos. So I tried a lot of sophisticated apps that can help you manage your to-dos. But ultimately, I'm ending up using the only Notes app that comes with iPhone. That's just a blank paper with just a check mark. And I think like if you're not able to do those to-dos, like none of the other apps help. So I definitely have that three categories, as in my PSV to-dos versus personal to-dos, and something I want to just explore as in doing while I'm working on these three things. So, but yeah, marking of to-dos were a criteria for me to getting a job, I would be the last person if I can get, because I don't end up doing my to-dos quite more often. So, but yeah, these are very useful insights. I love the idea of how you have categorize, as in you have multiple columns, action items, and the thing is like you have an estimate time that you associate those things. So that's something very beautiful. I think not a lot of people can do that in a very first go. So yeah, I hope people who are listening finds this useful, because this is one of the key insights a person who is a manager can share. So yeah, thanks for that. But apart from that, I think yeah, we are fairly out of time. So I'm gonna tune out. So I'll be linking for people who are coming to this podcast for the first time. I think Divya has a very nice YouTube channel. Well, he started off this channel, and I think there's a much more lot of content to be coming in, specifically for people who are interested into managerial roles, starting from interviews and a lot of nitty gritty details. Right, I think how to prepare for these roles, how to develop these skills. And I'll leave the plug to you, but I'll be also linking your YouTube channel in the description. So people who are specifically interested into that, they can check out. But apart from that, I'm really thankful. I think this was a very nice discussion, because I haven't had the chance to talk to a lot of not so tech background people. So I think this would be useful for people to have a diverse set of speakers. And I think it was useful. So thanks a lot for being here. And I hope this was useful to all the people who are listening.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and thanks for doing all of this work that you're doing for the research ecosystem. That's like really, really helpful, I'm sure, for everyone who's watching, and also for people who will watch this in the future when they discover this wonderful channel. So yeah, thanks for all the work that you're doing.